Broadcasting from Baltimore, Maryland, and all around the world, you're listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. Tune in each Thursday on iTunes for the latest episodes of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Sign up for the free show archive at investorhour.com. Here is your host, Dan Ferris.
Hello and welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm the editor of Extreme Value, a value investing service published by Stansberry Research. We have a really cool show. I'm just going to get to the rant, and then we're going to talk about some other stuff. We have an awesome guest today. So here we go with the rant. Okay, listen, the last two weekly rants were about gold. You remember 2 weeks ago I told you I thought everybody should own some gold, at least as an insurance policy, and then we talked about other reasons and other good things about gold. And then last week I said, you know, if you want to invest in gold mining stocks or any mining stocks, really, gold, copper, silver, lead, zinc, whatever, you should look for companies that do a few different types of businesses, but not mining companies, because mining is a terrible business. And I said you should look for royalties and streams, prospect generation, asset management, collateralized lending. I think I mentioned all those. And, you know, that's what I recommended that you do. Now, I can't help mentioning that the current issue of our Extreme Value newsletter, written by myself and Mike Barrett, just came out last Friday. It's the April issue, the April 2019 issue. And we recommended our third and, I'm going to say, probably final, maybe not definitely final, recommendation in the mining industry. It's a royalty company, just like I was talking about. And it's got a great management team. It's got a really interesting business model. That's all I'll say for now. The rest of it is for Extreme Value subscribers. If you want to become one of those, you can go to extremevalueoffer.com. And I really honestly did not plan to talk about gold 2 weeks leading up to that new royalty stock recommendation. I really didn't. It just turned out that way. So I just thought I'd mention it. But this week, I thought I might start like a 5-part series of rants, but I think I'm just going to do one, and then I'll see what you guys tell me in the feedback, because I don't want to commit to getting kind of technical for 5 weeks, and I'm going to get a little bit technical today. Okay, I'm going to talk about something that may be familiar to you if you're familiar with stuff I've written. Otherwise, you've probably never heard of this before. So, I'm going to talk about what I call my 5 essential financial clues. There are 5 financial metrics anybody can easily learn to find or calculate from any company's financial statements. And we've just found over time, I found that most of the really great businesses that we have recommended in the newsletter and that I found personally over 30 years and in this business for the last 21 years, they have at least 2 or 3 of these 5 clues. And most of the really great ones have 4 or even all 5 of them. So, you know, the 5 essential financial clues, then they're like it's like a stock screener. The 5 essential financial clues then are like a stock screener that kind of helps you pick out great businesses. Now, if you use those 5 as a stock screener, not everything that it picks is going to be great. But I think most of the great ones you'll find in the stock market, if you're doing research there, most of the great ones I've found over the past few decades tend to have, you know, like I said, 4 or 5 of them. All right, so I think these numbers I'm going to tell you about are so important, I cannot imagine picking your own stocks and running your own portfolio without knowing them. Whether you think they're important or not, you should know them. They're pretty basic analytical data points. And this is a key point. Listen up, skeezics. This is where analysis begins, not where it ends. This is, before I talk about these 5 numbers, which are, I'll just go through them real quick, probably toward the end of this rant. But the important thing here that I wanted to get to is, I think a lot of people make a huge mistake when they set out to manage their own money and buy their own stocks. They're all looking for this magic metric. What's the magic metric? You know, What's the one number that I can point to that every time that number is in a certain place, I'll make a ton of money buying stocks based on that? There's no such thing. There is no such thing. And these five numbers that I'm about to tell you about, like I said, they're the beginning. This is where you start. This is where analysis starts, not where it ends. Analysis is a process. Like, by the time we get to recommending a stock in extreme value, sometimes we'll have watched it literally for a couple of years, waiting for it to get cheap enough, waiting for the business to develop in a certain way, whatever. And it's always for weeks and weeks. You know, it's never just like, hey, I just heard of this company yesterday and the newsletter comes out tomorrow, let's do it. It doesn't work like that for us, for a two-man team that writes Extreme Value. And I don't think it should work that way for you either. You should really take your time and get to know the companies. If you're putting real money into real stocks that you're picking, you decide when to buy, you decide when to sell, you need to know what you're getting into. So there's no magic metric. Stop thinking that way. It's a process. You're peeling off the layers of an onion when you get to know a new company. There's no magic metric. All right, so with all that fanfare, I'm just going to tell you about these five numbers, and they're pretty cool, I think. The first one, and it's first on purpose, is free cash flow. This is just the cash profit that a business makes after all the taxes, expenses, interest charges, and capital expenditures necessary to maintain and grow the business are all paid. After all that, you get free cash flow. And when you tell someone you're a value investor, right, they want to know, where does this, you tell them that every business has an intrinsic value, and they say, well, where does that come from? How do you figure that out? Well, most of the time, you can't really do it without free cash flow or a similar number, right? Warren Buffett uses a similar number that he calls, usually pre-tax owner earnings, he calls it. Right, but it's just about the same thing, and the key point is that it's not just earnings; it's earnings minus capital necessary to maintain and grow the business, because that's not on the income statement. You got to go over and look on the cash flow statement for that number, capital expenditure. That's why we use free cash flow. But whatever you call it, it's really a very important number, right? And it's where, like, a business gets its value by all the excess cash that it throws off over the life of the business, right? That's what it's worth to you as an owner. That's what a stock is worth to you as an owner. And this is where you start figuring that out. Free cash flow is easy to calculate. You just go to the cash flow statement. You find two numbers, operating cash flow and capital expenditures. And free cash flow is operating cash flow minus capital expenditures. That's it. Now, sometimes they call operating cash flow payments for acquisition of property, plant, and equipment, or additions to property, plant, and equipment. And sometimes operating cash flow is called cash flows generated by operating activities or something like that. You can always, but, you know, they always look like something like that. And, you know, it's good to know those numbers. If you want to know more about those, you know, we talk about them in extreme value all the time. But that's the first one. Second one is consistent profit margins. Why consistent? Well, because in capitalism, it's just normal for profit margins to kind of get narrower over time. That's what competition does in capitalism, right? If somebody's earning a big fat profit margin, another company can come in. And an easy way to compete with that first company would be to say, well, we're going to do the same thing and we're just going to accept a little bit less profit margin. And so then they get into a war. And if the services are similar enough, you know, they can winnow the profit down to nothing, literally zero. So it becomes a bit of an anomaly when a company has consistent profit margins over a long period of time. The consistency is the most important part. Like, what's a good example? Costco is a good example. I think their net margin is still right around 1.5%. 1.5%. The gross margin's been around 12 or 13% for a long time. And that's just the way they run the business. You know, they have 4,000 SKUs, 4,000 different products in an average Costco warehouse. So, you know, you go into like Walmart or grocery store, you get 30 kinds of mustard. You go into Costco, you get, you know, two kinds of mustard, but they have an entire giant pallet stacked up to the ceiling, and you buy them in, you know, 8 packs or something. So they move the inventory real fast, and they can charge a lower profit margin, still make plenty of money. Okay? Consistent profit margins. That's second five of the five clues. Third one is good balance sheet, right? We all want a good balance sheet, because a good balance sheet, the definition of a great balance sheet is having a lot more cash than debt, right? If you owe $500,000 on your house and you've got, you know, $10 million in the bank, you've got a phenomenal balance sheet. Even if you got $1 million in cash and $500,000 on your house, that's a pretty good balance sheet. Having more cash, you know, than you owe. And I think they're like, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, like $250 billion in cash maybe these days, and something like $140 or $160 billion in debt. Don't quote me. But it's more, it's a ton of both, right? It's more debt than you can imagine, but it's much more cash than you can imagine. So it's a really great balance sheet. There are other great balance sheets where you get companies that might not have more cash than debt, but they cover their interest payments so many times over, like, you know, 10 or 12 or some, I've seen like 20, 30, 40 times sometimes. And that's a great balance sheet too. All right, that's number three, good balance sheet. So we got free cash flow, consistent margins, good balance sheet. We're cranking through these. Okay, now the next financial clue is number four, shareholder rewards. What does that mean? Well, I found that most of these great companies that have all these financial traits, they generally do a good job of buying back their stock, and a lot of them do a great job of paying dividends. Some of them pay a higher dividend. They'll raise their dividend every year for like decades and decades and decades. And we had, in the Extreme Value Model portfolio, we did have Procter & Gamble for a while. It's not in there anymore, but, you know, they paid a higher dividend every year for, I think it's something like 60 years. It's just an insanely long amount of time. They just keep raising the dividend again and again. So a really good company, you know, will do that. And they'll also be a really good opportunistic buyer of their own shares. So, you know, a typical kind of lousy corporate share repurchaser, you know, they'll just buy the shares no matter what they're trading at, you know, and the more money they make, the more shares they buy, and they don't mind paying an exorbitant valuation for their own shares. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to be very opportunistic and wait till the stock gets good and cheap and then do a massive repurchase. It's rare when you find that, but that's how, like, the initial guy, Henry Singleton from Teledyne Corporation, that's how he figured out how to do it. You know, the stock was cheap, his business was gushing cash flow, and he thought, well, this is an easy decision, started buying back his own shares, and then the thing went, like, you know, 5-1 pretty quick, or more. Actually, I think it might have gone 10-1. But anyway, it went way the heck up, okay, because he was buying shares cheap. So number four, shareholder rewards, that's share repurchases and dividends. All right, number five in the five essential financial clues is consistently high return on equity. Okay, what does that mean? Well, return on equity is kind of simple, actually. If a business were a bank account, return on equity is the interest rate you would earn on all the money you leave in it. Okay, it's that simple. And so we look for a consistently high return on equity because, remember, we talked about profit margins and we said, you know, in capitalism over time, it's normal for the profit margins to get smaller and smaller and smaller as competition comes in. Well, same thing with return on equity. The returns go down and down and down over time usually because competition winnows them away. So if you can find a business with a consistently high return on equity over a pretty good period of time, you know, 15, 20 years, or, you know, even 10 years sometimes can be a signal that something really great is happening. You know, you could have a really great business on your hands. High, consistently high. What's high? Well, high is like 20% on equity or more. I have recommended stocks where it was, you know, in the teens, in the high teens, you know, 15, 16, 17% return on equity. But pretty much, you know, 20% or more is high, especially if it's consistent. So those are the five financial clues. Free cash flow, and we want a business that gushes free cash flow, right? Consistent profit margins, good balance sheet, shareholder rewards, buybacks and dividends, remember that? And number five, consistently high return on equity. And what did I say before? This is where analysis begins, not ends. There are no magic metrics. These are not the magic metrics. In fact, one of the things I'm trying to do by giving you these things is kind of just break up the idea in your head that there's one number that you can follow that's going to lead you onto an easy fortune in the stock market. It just doesn't work that way. And if you really want to get to know the businesses that you own, whether it's a whole business or, you know, a share of a business in the stock market, these numbers are kind of important, are very important. They're basic analytical data points where you can start thinking about whether or not the business is really good. Okay, that's the rant. Write in at feedback@investorhour.com. Let me know what you think. And, you know, let's get on and find out what's new in the world. Okay, what's new? What's new? Well, one thing that's new, but not real new, it's kind of an ongoing new thing, is that Apple, you know, Apple, right? iPhone maker, and Qualcomm, the big smartphone, you know, chip maker, they don't like each other, and they have a lawsuit. Apple's lawsuit against Qualcomm is set to begin jury selection, and this could be potentially like, you know, the biggest intellectual property case ever, because there's just so much money at stake. Apple and I think four or five of its suppliers have suits against Qualcomm that could, you know, they're trying to sue them for like $27 billion total. And, you know, the CEOs are expected to take the stand. Maybe it'll be like a 4 or 5 week trial. I don't know. I'm just guessing there based on, you know, press reports. And Tim Cook is the CEO of Apple. Steve Mollenkopf is the CEO of Qualcomm. They have had a very tense meeting a year ago to try to hash out the patent issues that they're having problems with. Now, this is a huge, complicated legal matter, but I did notice that about a month ago, in the middle of March, Qualcomm did win a victory against Apple when a jury in San Diego, a federal jury, found that Apple owed the Qualcomm $31 million for infringing on three Qualcomm patents. Now, I don't know if that's meaningful, if that's telling us how this might go, but I've tried to read a bunch of different sources about this because it is a big, complex legal thing. And one of them suggested that this is kind of a test of Qualcomm's business model. And one of the beefs that Apple has is, like, apparently when you deal with Qualcomm, you pay them twice. You got to sign a licensing agreement up front, and you pay for that, and then you pay again in the price of chips, you know, where the patents are, you know, apply. And they don't like that. And Apple and these other supplier companies are asking, you know, they want an end to this, and they want a refund of like $9 billion, which may be tripled. Okay, I think that's how we get to the $27 billion. They're asking for $9 billion, and it could be tripled if the jury finds in Apple's favor and finds that there were, you know, antitrust violations, okay? So that's where we get the $27 billion. But there are billions on the line, even if that doesn't happen. So this is huge. It could be huge for both companies. I have no idea how this is going to turn out, but we'll see, and we'll see if it has, it has major implications for both businesses. They're both being essentially pressured legally, by the other company, to do something that will wind up with them, potentially making a lot less money. So, really interesting situation. Lots of press reports, lots to unpack. We're not going to do it here. I'm not a lawyer, but I sure as heck want to see the effect on both their stock prices as this thing plays out. Interesting. Okay, next. So the retail world has passed a key benchmark, and not a good one. Apparently, U.S. retailers have announced more store closures so far this year than they did in all of last year. So in all of last year, there were 5,864 store closures in the U.S. retail sector. And so far this year, they've announced 5,994, about 130 more than all of last year. And, of course, this is just because we're all online now, right? We're all buying stuff online. We've bought toilet paper on Amazon. We don't even go to Costco for toilet paper anymore. Actually, my wife doesn't like the stuff we bought online, so I will be going back to Costco. But, if you find the good stuff online, you don't even need to do that. This guy Scott Galloway is a really good analyst. He wrote a book called The Four about Amazon and Facebook and Google and Apple. And he's got a lot of smart things to say about these companies. And one of the things he was saying one time is he said, right now an Amazon Prime member spends like $1,300 a year. He said, over time, this is going to be $13,000 a year because they're going to just take away all the boring parts of shopping you don't want. And what do you do now for the boring parts of shopping? Well, you go to a grocery store. You go to maybe you're still going to the mall for some things. Data I'm looking at says for every 1% increase in online penetration, you got 8,000 to 8,500 stores that will be closing. Wow. That's brutal, isn't it? I mean, it's just brutal. And the record for a single year was actually 2017. You remember the retail apocalypse, it was a big deal. And just under 8,000 retail stores closed, or the closures were announced that year. I don't know if they all took place in 2017, but they were all announced that year. And this year, Payless Shoes alone is closing all 2,500 of its U.S. stores. So, almost half of the total that's been announced so far this year. So it's brutal out there in retail land. And it's easy to see why every time you talk about almost any business these days, somebody says, yeah, but what about Amazon? They're going to destroy it, right? I mean, I'm invited to the ValueX Vail conference, which takes place in June. And I go every year and you have to get an invitation. It's run by Vitaly Katsanelson, who we had on the program a while back. And I think this year, I didn't present last year, and this year I'd like to present. And no matter what idea, I sent an idea in, and Vitaly said, well, okay, but what about Amazon? You really have to tell us about Amazon with this company. So, it's not just stuff in the news. It's real, Real investors are really worried about Amazon, and with good reason. They do what they do very well. All right, one more item here. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I can't remember the last time I said there's an African IPO, but yes, the Amazon of Africa. It's a, like a billion-dollar startup that just went public. And the company is called Jumia, J-U-M-I-A. And they raised just under $200 million in their IPO. And the shares, I think it went public around $14. I was just looking at a chart. I didn't look at the news or anything. But the chart just indicated that the thing started trading at $14 and it was like 30 something when I looked at it. This ticker symbol is JMIA. Yeah, $37. It's up, you know, as I'm talking to you. That's like what? From 14 to 37, you know, much better than a double just in a couple days here. So, wow, that's really cool. We have an African-focused venture capital funded tech company that has gone public on major global exchange in New York and, you know, on the NYSE, and it's doing really great and people want it. I wonder, you know, IPOs do great sometimes in the first couple of days, but, you know, looking at how disappointing Lyft has been and the prospects for, you know, that business ever making money, you know, with Uber, the bigger competitor, losing $3 billion a year, here we have an IPO that actually looks like it might work. Nice to see. So that's all the news I want to talk about today. We're going to talk about, I had some news on Tesla, but instead of doing that, let's just get to our guest, Whitney Tilson. He's going to give us an update on Tesla and lots of other cool stuff. So let's do that right now. All right, everybody, as promised, we have a really great guest today. It's Whitney Tilson. And Whitney Tilson is a former hedge fund manager who graduated at the top of his class at Harvard and Harvard Business School. He helped launch Teach for America, then later launched his own hedge fund, where he grew from $1 million to $200 million over a period of 20 years. Not bad. He's the most connected man on Wall Street. He's met Warren Buffett, Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. He was a regular on CNBC, Bloomberg TV, Fox Business. He's appeared on 60 Minutes. He's been profiled by the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and more. And his calls have been so prescient that CNBC once nicknamed him The Prophet. Please welcome Whitney Tilson. Hello, Whitney.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Actually, Whitney, you know, I've been doing the podcast since, last fall or so, and you're my first repeat guest.
Oh, well, that's a great honor. I'll try. I forget what I said last time, so I'll try to say something fresh and new for you.
You know, it's funny because, you know, somebody asked me, like, people ask me about Tesla all the time, and I know you talk a lot about it, but people asked me about Tesla this week, and I said, well, hold that thought. I'm talking to Whitney Tilson on the podcast this week. So I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just kind of, you know, top of your head, sort of giving us the update. You put out a lot of great emails about this, so I know you're kind of up to speed on it.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating company. I'm going to try and be succinct here, but it's hard because there's so many moving pieces, and I have such mixed feelings about both the company, its products, and its entrepreneurial founder, Elon Musk. It was my worst short of my hedge fund career, just as background. In 2013, the company was within a week of filing for bankruptcy, was my analysis at the time, later confirmed in various books, et cetera. But the company pulled off a miracle. The Model S launched. It was an absolute hit. Everyone I know who's ever owned the car, you know, loves it more than life itself. And the stock became a phenomenon and developed a cult following. And it went up, you know, from $35 to over $200 on a rope. And I got burned pretty badly on the short side because I dug in my heels. I clung to my old investment thesis. I didn't recognize that, hey, Elon Musk and his engineers have pulled off a miracle here. They drew an inside straight against me. I thought I made a high probability bet, but they pulled it off, and I should have recognized that and gotten out quickly once the story changed. It's very dangerous being short open-ended situations in huge global markets with a stock with a cult following. So some very good lessons on the short side. So for years, I warned all my short-selling friends, don't short Tesla for the reasons I just cited. But I reversed myself, and about a month ago or a month and a half ago, when they pre-announced that Q1 earnings were going to come in, not earnings, but deliveries, were going to come in well short of expectations, when they announced that, contrary to previous guidance, that they would be consistently profitable going forward, as they were in Q3 and Q4 last year, that they were going to lose money in the first quarter. It became clear to me that Tesla has a big demand problem, and I went very public and said that that I think Tesla is the most dangerous stock in America right now. It's got a $50 billion market cap almost, and I think that could get cut by two-thirds. I predicted a stock price below $100 a share about a month ago, and so far events since then have only reinforced my view that you know, the company has incredible cars but has a lot of competition coming, and they have solved their production difficulties, but now they've got a demand problem. Thanks in part to a lot of new competition coming out. In many ways, Tesla has done a great service to humanity for being a pioneer in electric cars and almost single-handedly forcing every major auto manufacturer in the world to invest billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars collectively, in developing cars in this space. That is great for humanity, but now that that tidal wave of competition is hitting the showrooms, it's very bad for Tesla. So interestingly enough, I think that Tesla is to some extent going to be a victim of its own success. So I sort of hope they're successful, but I think like so many trailblazing early pioneering companies, they're going to suffer mightily as all the giants in the industry, you know, come in and start competing with them.
And that's sort of where we are right now. You think we're at this point? We're at the call it inflection, if you will, where competition becomes so great.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I look for as an investor, both on the long side and the short side, where I look for inflection points where a stock is about to move in a big way in one direction or the other. And obviously, it go long the upward moves and attempt to short or at least avoid the downward moves. And I really think Tesla hit an inflection point a little over a month ago. And the key to these inflection points is perceiving something that becomes obvious to me, but the market hasn't yet figured it out, and hence a big mispricing in the stock. So Tesla stock has such a cult following that, you know, on the fundamentals, the big losses expected in the first quarter, the drying up of demand, the fact that the new Audi and Jaguar cars over in Europe, in Norway, for example, which has been one of the leading markets in Europe, the Model S and Model X, not counting the Model 3, where there's a lot of pent-up demand, but the older Tesla cars that are competing head-to-head against Jaguar and Audi are getting outsold 5-1 by the Jaguar and Audi cars, right? So there's evidence everywhere that Tesla has a big demand problem, and you can just simply look at the balance sheet and the cash flow statement. They've got an awful lot of debt. They really need to raise capital, and it's very puzzling to me that they haven't. So this could, I don't think the company's going to go bankrupt, because there are enough deep-pocketed people who've sort of bought into the story and just love Elon Musk and worship the ground he walks on. So Tesla will probably be able to raise money, but I think it may be in a distressed situation, you know, in the range of $100 a share, you know, nowhere near today's level above 250.
Right. And as we've talked about in the past too, that moment can come upon you with a suddenness that will just shock you. One day you can wake up and, you know, you're down 30, 40, 50%, something like that.
Yes.
So that's
I've seen it happen, and Tesla is certainly the kind of stock where that could happen. Though honestly, if you ask me, the way I think it gets to $100 a share is not on a straight line, but rather what it's been doing for the past month, which is just almost every day, you know, as the scales fall from, you know, incrementally more investors' eyes every day, the stock just sort of bleeds. It just gets weaker and weaker and just sort of slowly declines.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, you know,
for
it's,
sure.
You know, shorting is a very difficult business, and I caution your listeners about running out and shorting Tesla. It's also the kind of stock that, you know, expectations are now pretty low. And so any hint of good news, any hint that they're raising capital, you know, the stock could easily pop 10 or 20%. So you have to be prepared for that. You know, every stock on its way down a long ways usually, you know, doubles at least some points on the way down, right? So,
right.
So it's one to be cautious, but it's an absolutely fascinating case study. It's really the most interesting case study I've seen since Valiant, you know, rose 20-fold and then declined by 97%, where you had some of the smartest investors in the world on both sides, long and short that stock. And I never had any position in either side in Valiant, but I studied it super closely because it's such a great case study. I learned so much from it in so many ways. So I think Tesla is similar.
All right. Well, thank you for the update. And who knows, maybe if this thing crashes and burns, we'll have you back on to talk about it someday. But I want to tell the listener, listen to what Whitney just told you about shorting, because he knows, and I know this from personal experience. Whitney, I remember one time I was in the audience and you were speaking at one of the Value Investing Congress events, and you were literally at that moment on stage saying, I can't remember the name of the stock, I'm sorry, but you were saying, you know, don't short this thing. It's really, you know, you're like standing in front of a freight train. And I swear to you, just at the moment you were saying that, the fellow next to me leaned over and said, I just got my short called away. It was just the weirdest thing. So, in other words, you were spot on to the minute. And I keep telling people this about you. He's spot on to the minute. What did you call the Bitcoin top was like within an hour? I mean, you must,
yeah,
you know, you and I both know,
I mean,
there's a lot of luck involved.
You know, I mean, I called the top of Tilray and the pot stock bubble to the hour. I called the top of Bitcoin at 20,000 to the hour. Tilray was at 300 for those who follow that stock. But, you know, sometimes I've been off by years and sometimes I've been wrong. But, you know, as I get more experienced as an investor, to really get the timing on something right, you have to do more than just the fundamental analysis, which I've always done. But you start to get a feel for the market, for investor psychology, and you know, you look for little tells. Like in the case of Bitcoin, what finally caused me to say that's it. I mean, I've been skeptical of Bitcoin forever, right? It's inherently worthless. It will never become an instrument that any will gain any widespread acceptance. There's no way to calculate its intrinsic value. So I've been skeptical of Bitcoin for a while, but what caused me to call the top when I did is I was getting in 1 week, I got three calls or emails from friends of mine. You know, my tennis pro, some guy who runs a nonprofit, neither of whom know anything about investing. And then the clincher was a buddy of mine who's a former Navy SEAL who now trains Navy SEALs out in Coronado in San Diego. He told me that Navy SEALs were coming back from deployment in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Somalia and getting their hardship bonuses for the combat duty that they'd been doing. And they were taking their year-end bonuses and buying one Bitcoin with it. That just told me, you know, that's it. You know, when this is the kind of speculative frenzy that Navy SEALs coming home from deployment are investing in, there's nobody else left to buy. That's the peak of the bubble. So that's why I made my big call. So, the case of Tilray, it was almost as funny. I was on my way to the studios at Yahoo Finance to go on their national webcast. To talk about Tilray and the overvalued pot stocks. And by the way, Tilray is a real company, unlike Bitcoin, which is inherently speculative and there's no way to calculate its value. Tilray is a real company and has some real assets and is worth something. Its price got caught up in a speculative bubble. So as I was walking into the building, my daughter, who's a sophomore at Wake Forest and is taking a class on personal finance, called me up and said, Daddy, we're doing this exercise to teach us about the stock market. I have a $25,000 model portfolio, not real money, thankfully. And I just bought the stock of Tilray because a friend told me, you know, one of my classmates told me about it. And this was the first stock she's ever owned in her life. And she's fortunate she didn't really own it. Again, you know, when someone, the least sophisticated investor in the United States is piling into Tilray, you know it's the top of the bubble. And sure enough, that was the day to the hour when my daughter called me.
Wow. So I wonder if, you know, you could just kind of give her my phone number next time she wants to buy something, you know, or maybe you could shoot us all an email. My daughter just called, you know, and then that'll be the next one. Of course, she probably learned, though. I imagine your kids are very smart, and they'll probably learn from that. So
yeah, they're turning 23, 20, and 17. Now, my middle daughter, the one I just mentioned, in fact, is 20 today. In fact, it's her birthday. But they are slowly starting to take an interest in what I do and in the financial world. And so hopefully that will continue. I love teaching, and I find it sort of ironic that I teach so many other people, and I think I do a good job of it, and I've done an absolutely miserable job of teaching my own children.
I was going to ask, you know, if any of them are, you know, studying finance in school or just showing an interest in the business, but you're saying they're just starting to show an interest.
Yeah, well, my oldest daughter graduated from college a year ago. She's working at Ernst & Young in consulting and is studying for the GMATs. In other words, will be applying to business school probably within a year or so, maybe as soon as this fall. And who knows, maybe she'll follow in my footsteps to Harvard Business School. I would be proud of that. So she's really taking an interest. She was an economics major at Carleton College. And my middle daughter looks like she's going to major in marketing. So there appears to be some budding interest.
I see. So you went to Harvard Business. Were you, were you like one of these Warren Buffett guys buying stocks when you're 11 years old, or did the interest in investing come later for you?
You know, I was very late, and it was it's partly because just the household I grew up in. My parents were in the Peace Corps, met and married in the Peace Corps in 1962, the third couple to do so according to family lore. And so, you know, I grew up in a household where my parents never owned a stock in their entire lives. They were just sort of thrifty, frugal teachers. And so when I finally did discover value investing in Warren Buffett, it immediately resonated with me, the idea of hunting for bargains and trying to buy dollar bills for 50 cents. But it was, you know, all through college and then helping start Teach for America, a couple years at Boston Consulting Group, and then into Harvard Business School. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I had a very strong interest in business that developed in college, but I had no interest in the stock market. So whenever I remember the Wall Street Journal would come, I would throw away the money and investing section and just read the rest of the paper. So Warren Buffett came to speak at Harvard Business School. He no longer visits business schools. This was, you know, 25 years ago. But he came. He used to come to Harvard and Columbia, you know, every other year, I think. And so he came to speak on campus at Harvard Business School, and I didn't even go listen to him. And that's how foolish I was. I didn't even know who he was. So it wasn't until a couple years after business school, I'd gotten married. My wife had a good job as a lawyer. And we finally paid off my business school debt, and I looked one day at my checking account, and I had $10,000 in it. We'd saved our first $10,000, and that was a new experience for me. I thought I was rich. And so one of my close friends from college was Bill Ackman, the famous billionaire hedge fund manager, and he was one of those kids who grew up in an investing-related household. His multi-generation, his father and grandfather were in the New York City real estate business, so he was deep into investing and buying stocks at a very young age. And so maybe a little bit of that rubbed off on me. And so at least I knew who to call once I had my first $10,000 to invest. And so I called up Bill, and I still remember what he said. He said, Whitney, all you need to do is read everything Warren Buffett's ever written about investing, and you can stop there. You don't need to read anything else. And so I started reading about Buffett. I started reading his annual letters. And I was hooked. And it was the late 90s. Stocks were going up. So I started dabbling in stocks and buying a few stocks in my own account. And honestly, I had no idea what I was doing. I was buying based on hot stock tips from a friend. But eventually, I went out to my first Berkshire meeting in the mid to late 90s and started talking to Bill more frequently and cultivated the right friends and mentors. And really, over time, it took a while, but over time, I became a real value investor. And at that point, decided to start my own fund on January 1st of 1999, just about 20 years ago.
Okay, Whitney, so I'm going to fast forward to now. And you have, actually, to me, like, you're one of the classic investors who has evolved. You know, you started out as this fundamental value investor. You're still a fundamental investor, and I might even still call you a value investor, but I notice you don't call yourself that lately. You called yourself a make money investor at the conference you and I attended a couple weeks ago for Stansberry. And that's interesting to me because I think all the good investors go through this transformation. They start out, a lot of them start out looking at charts and trying to figure out what direction the stock price is going to go in. Then eventually they say, well, maybe I'll try to figure out what industry is good to invest in. And then that doesn't work out. And then they start learning about the fundamentals of businesses. And eventually, if they start out in the sort of what I would say the traditional, almost dogmatic value world, they end up, if they're really good, where you are. And so tell us, I'm not going to tell everyone, you tell us, where are you right now in your evolution as an investor?
Yeah. Look, I'm still a value investor, but I'm a value investor, like you pointed out, someone who's learned and matured and developed. And the way I would characterize it I did too much in my early career. I define value investing as buying stocks trading at low multiples of earnings or revenue or book value, depending on the type of stock. And so that was my screen. And I would assemble a group of companies that all had cheap stocks. And then I understood, of course, it's important to find good quality businesses. Those are more likely to turn around and grow over time. And also, I appreciated that. But my first screen was valuation. And so what I did is I took all cheap stocks and then tried to find better businesses among the pool of cheap stocks. And I had it exactly backwards. I think the way to be a successful long-term investor is you need to screen for good companies and then try to find, then among the pool of good companies, the vast majority of which are going to be widely perceived as good and investors are going to love them. And their stock prices are going to reflect the quality of the business, and you're probably not going to make much money just buying popular, beloved stocks. So the key is to look among the pool of high-quality businesses and find those that have temporarily fallen out of favor due to factors that can be fixed. So that's the hard part, which is, there are lots of formerly great businesses that are struggling right now. And the question is, which ones are encountering temporary difficulties? Those are the stocks you want to own that can be fixed and turn around and return to glory versus those that are in permanent decline. So, a classic, there's so many of these so-called value traps of formerly great businesses that just go down and down and down. Kodak declined into bankruptcy, when digital imagery and photography and printing came along. A stock like the New York Times, newspapers used to be the world's greatest businesses for a century or more, were incredible businesses. And then the internet came along and most newspapers and their stocks faded into oblivion. Though, interestingly, the New York Times is now the stock's actually trading at multi-year highs as they have enough of a franchise and a brand name and are starting to monetize digital, but most newspaper companies have just faded away. So, what you want to look for, of course, is one of the best investments of my early career was McDonald's when the stock went from 44 to 12 from 2000 to early 2003. And they were in a price war with Burger King, and that's a fixable problem. Price wars tend to end, but everyone was thinking, oh, Americans are going to eat healthier from now on, and they won't eat burgers and fries, which is, of course, complete nonsense. And so, the stock is up 15 times since then. And I had a heck of a ride, not the entire 15 times, unfortunately, but I had a heck of a ride on that. So that's what I call, you know, make money investing. I'm looking for companies where earnings are going to grow a lot going forward. Ideally, I can pick them up cheap when the stock is depressed. But you know what? You can just buy something like Google today, and it's not a depressed stock. Earnings have never crashed. It's never been a turnaround situation. But it's got an incredible growth runway, I think, for the next 10 or 20 years. I think earnings are going to be a lot higher in 5 years. And if I'm right, the stock's going to be at least a double in the next 3 to 5 years. So you don't have to be doing bottom fishing.
Right. And you've pointed out some really good optionality in Google, too, haven't you?
Yes. I think three of the most undervalued or mispriced options in the world are embedded in Google. Number one is the value of YouTube, which is just an extraordinary platform, has something like 7 to 9 times the viewing hours of Netflix. This entity is not being valued very much within Google because they're being very cautious in ramping up the advertising and in monetizing it. But if Netflix is worth $150 billion, YouTube is worth a lot more than that with 7 to 9 times the viewing hours. A second embedded option is Android, which runs something like 75% of the world's mobile phones. Google has been giving it away for free. Interestingly, the European regulators are sort of putting pressure on them to start charging for it. If Google charged $5 for every new phone installed with Android, that would be more than $5 billion a year of incremental pure profit to Google. And lastly, I think Google's Waymo division of autonomous driving appears, as best I can tell, to have a big lead over all of its competitors. And I think autonomous driving is going to be, will change the world in many ways. Analysts are estimating Waymo could be worth $100 billion and up right now if they were Google were to spin it out. I think if you just look at Google's cash flows from its core search business and advertising business, keep in mind they have 7 products currently that have 1 billion monthly average users or more. So their core business is just gushing cash, and it's trading at a pretty modest multiple of its core business profitability. So I think you're getting these three $100-plus billion options for free.
Wow. Makes me want to run out and buy Google.
I think you could do worse. Interestingly, I think if you told me that I had to buy 2 stocks, 50-50, mm-hmm. A portfolio of 50% each of 2 stocks – that I think was most likely to beat the S&P 500 over the next, call it 5 to 10 years. Those 2 stocks would be Berkshire Hathaway and Google. I don't think either stock I would want to put 100% in because, you know, you just don't know, you can't just own Berkshire because what if technology has a big run and, you know, Berkshire could underperform in a tech-focused stock market, right? But Google is the opposite, right? So you need to have a balance of both. But I think those two companies are pretty reasonably valued and just have incredible virtuous cycles working, incredible long runways. And they're both very large. You have to have modest expectations. If you told me, pick 2 stocks where I would outperform the S&P 500 by the greatest margin over the next 10 years, I wouldn't pick Google and Berkshire because they're already so large. But in terms of the likelihood of doing well and doing a little bit better than an index fund, which I think is a very reasonable default option for most people, those 2 stocks would be my picks.
Well, interesting that Berkshire is one of the ones that you think will outperform. What is Buffett saying about, you know, the future? I thought he just becomes more and more conservative in his projections over time, and I didn't know if he was still saying that he thinks we'll beat the index.
Well, he's been cautioning Berkshire shareholders for decades to diminish their expectations that the years of vast outperformance are over, and with Berkshire with a $500 billion market cap today, is that's no doubt a true statement. I think Berkshire will keep up in a bull market and will go down less in a bear market. So net net over 5 to 10 years, I think is a good bet to outperform the S&P by a few percentage points a year. If the S&P does 5 percentage points a year over the next 10 years, compounds at 5% a year, you know, I think Berkshire might do 7% a year, right? Not huge outperformance, right, but that adds up over a 10-year period, right? And I think Berkshire is going to start buying back a lot of stock. That's something Buffett has been very clear about, which I think could be a very nice catalyst. So, you know, Buffett is always an under-promise, over-deliver kind of guy. I think that's the right way to invest. It's the right way to live your life. And I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say in just a couple of weeks now, 2 weeks from Saturday, when I'll be attending my 22nd consecutive annual Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting out in Omaha.
So, Whitney, last night you had a webinar to launch your new product with Stansberry, and maybe just tell us a little bit about your new product. What's it called? What can readers of it expect? And, you know, how did things go last night?
Sure. Things went incredibly well, and it's such a treat partnering up with Stansberry to create this new entity called Empire Financial Research. And I have you to thank for connecting me with my old friend Porter and suggesting that we have a conversation last summer, which is what led to this. So thank you, Dan. We're hopefully going to launch a number of newsletters under the Empire Financial Research umbrella, but we launched the first one last night called the Empire Investment Report. It's a monthly newsletter that I and my analyst are writing. And it's our absolute best stock ideas that we're going to be sharing with our subscribers. We launched yesterday with 4 big cap stocks that we shared publicly to anyone, whether subscriber or not, anyone who came to the webinar. My big 3 favorite tech stocks, Alphabet, Facebook, and Amazon, as well as Berkshire Hathaway, which I think are 4 stocks that can provide a nice foundation for a conservative portfolio. And then only to our subscribers, we revealed in our first issue of the Empire Investment Report a smaller stock that, you know, is a little riskier but has a lot more upside. And we're going to look to every month now be releasing new stock ideas and building a portfolio over time. And it'll be very similar to what I did for 20 years when I ran my hedge fund, which is do a lot of talking to people, reading, thinking, analysis, and in-depth research to try and come up with one good investment idea a month. And most of the time for the first couple of years, it will be a new stock idea to add to the portfolio. But over time, we'll have 2 to 3 dozen companies that we follow closely, and not all of their stocks will be cheap enough to own at any given time. So we will recommend our favorite dozen stocks at any given time that will be our active portfolio. And just as a little teaser for the first issue, for those folks who might be interested in subscribing, it's a stock that I was once short, and now I am recommending going long or owning it. And this is only the 5th time in my 20-year career that I have ever gone long a stock that I was once short. And the first 4 were a double in a year, a triple in a year, a 5-bagger in 2 years, and a 50-bagger in 6 years. So when the rare conditions line up for reversing my opinion and going from short to long a stock, my track record's been perfect so far with some pretty extraordinary results, and I'm pretty confident I'll be 5 for 5 after this one works out. So it's still cheap. It's still available in my inaugural issue.
Wow. I can't wait to find out what that is myself. So, wow, that's really cool. I'm looking forward to reading this. And we have a special offer for Stansberry Investor Hour listeners. So you can get 1 year of Whitney's Empire Investment Report. It's normally $5,000. But for Stansberry Investor Hour listeners, it's 40% off today for $3,000. 1 year for $3,000 also includes several urgent buy recommendations. And you can get more details at www.WhitneyTilsonEvent.com. WhitneyTilsonEvent.com. So, wow, thanks, Whitney. I'm really always happy when you can make time for us, and I hope you'll do so again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and look forward to coming back. Maybe, as you referred to earlier, I'll come back and do a little victory dance on Tesla.
Yeah, I know. It's like it may be inevitable, but it's not always imminent, these things. But I think you're right. I think the moment has come. So hopefully we'll be doing that by the end of the year.
All right. Thanks again, Dan.
You bet. Thank you, Whitney. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Time for the mailbag. Remember, your feedback is important to us here. I personally read every single email that comes in, and we respond to I respond to as many as I can. Obviously, there's too many. I can't respond to all of them, but it's really valuable to us. It's an important part of the show. It's some of the most fun I have all week, and you can write to us at feedback@investorhour.com. Now, last week, our guest Brian Dalton was the founder and CEO of Altius Minerals, a company I've been covering for 10 years in extreme value, and so we got plenty of questions about Altius, and I thought I would just devote the whole mailbag to Altius questions today. All right, so number one says, "Hi, Dan. I enjoyed your interview with Brian Dalton and became interested in Altius Minerals." It's Altius, A-L-T-I-U-S. It's the Olympic motto. The Olympic Games motto is Citius Altius Fortius. It's Latin for faster, higher, stronger. And Brian chose the middle term, higher, as the name of the company, Altius Minerals. So this guy says, "I enjoyed your interview and became interested in Altius Minerals Corporation, so I went to look for more information on this royalty company. I found the ticker symbol ATUSF and another ticker symbol ALS.TO, along with others listed on different exchanges. If these represent the same company, which one should I own, or does it even matter?" And he says, "ATUSF has a lower market cap than ALS.TO, so assuming Yahoo has them both priced in dollars, does this provide insight into the better value selection? Sorry for such basic questions, Ken B." No need to apologize, Ken, because this is an excellent question, and this is like one of the main things I deal with on Altius. I mean, I've dealt with this month after month for 10 years. So it's a great question, Ken. Thank you. The ticker symbol ATUSF is the same exact share as the ticker symbol ALS on the Toronto Stock Exchange. One of them is priced in U.S. dollars, ATUSF, and has the U.S. in there to remind you of that. And the other one is priced in Canadian dollars, ALS.TO on Yahoo. And while we're at it, Yahoo will give you a good stock quote, and they can tell you the market cap of a company, but, you know, it's not the place to get data, folks. It's just not. You need something better, just as an aside. So, yeah, about these two ticker symbols. So, it really is up to you, but I can tell you this. The ATUSF symbol is a little less liquid than the one traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and it's priced in U.S. dollars, so here's the dynamic. When the U.S. dollar is weaker, ATUSF will tend to do better, will perform better than ALS. Now, ALS is priced in Canadian dollars, so when the Canadian dollar is weaker, it will do better than ATUSF. I know it sounds wrong, but I promise you that's the way it works. Generally speaking, right? Not every minute of every day, but generally speaking. So thank you, Ken B., for that. Number two, I almost didn't include this one because it's a little snarky, and, you know, I did my little thing before where I said we're not going to do rude emails, but he didn't get rude. He's just a little snarky, so I let it through, and it's a good question. "As you were touting the value of Altius Minerals, I was looking at the Yahoo graphs and stats. 1.2% dividend with a payout ratio of 533, flat price for last 5 years, PE of 439. How could a non-insider like me possibly make any money on this with four question marks? Apparently, you are saying its book value is rapidly appreciating, but how does that translate to money in my pocket ever? Martin J. Couple of things here, Martin J. First of all, Yahoo sucks for stats and things, so it doesn't, you know, that's the first problem. But these stats are actually probably accurately portrayed. They're just meaningless. The payout ratio on Yahoo is meaningless. The PE ratio on Yahoo is meaningless. And it's probably accurate, but it's the ratio of the current price to the current reported GAAP earnings. And what did I say in today's rant? All these basic numbers, this is where analysis begins, not where it ends. If you think you know, if you think the PE ratio of any company anywhere tells you a lot or enough of anything, you are wrong, period. I stopped looking at PE ratio a while ago. I mean, I can't help it because everywhere I go, it's in my face, but I learned to ignore it because it just doesn't matter. What matters is the intrinsic value of the business. And I keep track of the intrinsic value of Altius probably as well as anyone on earth. And I've got just shy of $18 all day long with the stock around $12 or $13 lately. And, you know, you read my newsletter and I will make the case for it. I'm not going to do it here, but yeah. So you need to do a lot more work than just looking at all these headline numbers on Yahoo. And the stock is definitely undervalued. Like, nobody who knows the royalty industry will tell you otherwise. And that's all there is to it. There's another question in the same vein by Peter G. He said, I enjoy your interview with the gentleman from Altius. And it seems like the PE ratio is 400 and the future PE is 44. Am I missing something here? And yeah, I would say you are. That's not, those numbers aren't meaningful. Ignore them and you know, do some real work in the company or just read my stuff. Okay, number three. Number three is also about Altius. This is our last one. All right, so good morning, Dan. I finished listening to the Altius Minerals show this morning on the way to work. That was excellent and certainly one that I will listen to again this weekend. Brian was droll but fascinating, kind of like you. Oh, thanks. But what a story and a very compelling sales pitch. I'm going to investigate adding ATUSF to my portfolio, but I'm hoping you can answer a few quick questions for me. I'm not familiar with the royalty concept and don't understand the investment return process. Altius takes royalty payments and dividends from the companies they have invested in, and then what? They pay them out to shareholders in the form of royalty payments, dividends? Are the dividends separate from the royalty payments and maybe in addition to? With gross revenue of $67 million and 43 million shares outstanding, that amounts to about $1.50 per share in roundabout terms. I'm fairly sure that not all the revenue passes through. Perhaps next week you could give us a primer on how this works. At a dividend of only, you said 12 cents a year. It's actually 16 cents a year. That produces a pretty measly yield, so I'm really hoping there's something besides yield forming the basis of the return. Okay, a couple of things. First of all, I believe this dividend is going to continue to grow the way it has grown in the past, which to date is just shy of 18% per year. And the way you assess dividend yield, if you think you're going to get growth, is you add the yield to the growth. Do not write me a million emails and say this is wrong. I've had these emails before. This is just a standard, basic, rule of thumb, back of the envelope dividend model. It is true. It is correct. Okay? Add the yield to what you think the growth is going to be, and that's the kind of return you can expect. So, you know, 1.2 plus about, as I recall, 17.8 is about 20%. And I think you are going to make 20% a year over the next 5 or 10 years on Altius. I think you're going to make better than that. I think you're going to get a 5-10 bagger out of this thing over the next decade. But to answer your question, look, you asked a lot of questions in there, but it's real simple. They own royalties, and they own one royalty stock, the Labrador Iron Ore Royalty Corporation shares. So that pays them dividends. But all that dividend comes out of royalties on the IOC mine up there in Labrador, like we were talking about on the show. So, yeah, they get their royalty payments from the royalties they own, and then they get the dividend payments from Labrador, and they pay that out in dividends, period. Now, of course, they don't pay all of it out, but they're growing in the amount that they pay out. They do other things with it. They invest it. They pay down debt. These guys are very conservative about debt, so they like to use some of this money to pay down their debt. I think they could wind up with zero debt over the next several years, depending on what new investments they're able to make. So I hope that answers your question. It's real simple. Royalties and dividends in, dividend payments out, and they do other things with that money. And over time, I think the yield over your cost, if you're buying the stock today, I think you are going to be getting a very fat yield over your cost, you know, 5+ years out from now. But good question. All good questions on Altius. And I'm thrilled about the company. I hope we gave you the impression that there were some issues, but they're all pretty much solved. So the business is firing on all cylinders. And, the one guy asked about the stock going sideways for 5 years. If that means something to you, I can't help you. What means something to me is the business, the value proposition. The thing's gushing cash flow, and it's cheap. And the management is the number one royalty company management on the face of the earth. So that's all good, and what happened to the stock price in the past just doesn't mean a whole lot to me. All right, so that concludes another episode of Stansberry Investor Hour. Thank you for joining us again. You can check out all our episodes on the recently revamped website, and you can see show transcripts. You can enter your email to make sure you get all the updates on the show, okay? Just go to www.investorhour.com. That's it for this week. Thank you once again, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email at feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is provided for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.